Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
You're walking along and there's a full moon and I think, oh, I should read some Basho. It's
and we know how you love the moon from your dissertation.
I love the bloody moon, me. Can't get enough of the moon. I really do talk about the moon a lot. I've got him such a woman.
Oh no, join the club, I do too.
With thanks to Baileys, this is the Women's Prize for Fiction podcast, celebrating women's writing, sharing our creativity, our voices, and our perspectives, all while championing the very best fiction written by women around the world. I'm Vic Hope, and I'm your host for season 5 of the Women's Prize for Fiction podcast, the podcast that asks women with lives as inspiring as any fiction to share the 5 books by women that have shaped them. We have a phenomenal lineup of guests, and I guarantee you'll be taking away plenty of reading recommendations. I am very excited that this week our brilliant guest is actor Ophelia Lovibond. Ophelia began honing her skills in a youth theatre club at the age of 10. Since then, she's been working for over 2 decades, taking a variety of roles, including Apple's Trying, BBC's Roadkill, Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy, CBS's Elementary, and recently, This England, a series about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, in which she plays his wife, Carrie Johnson. Her latest role in Minx sees her front and centre as the exuberant young feminist Joyce Prigger, who seeks to dismantle the rigid gender norms of the 1970s by creating the first erotic magazine for women. Welcome to the podcast, Ophelia.
Thank you for having me.
I know you studied English at university, so have you always been an avid reader?
Yes, I mean, very much so. I know it's quite a cliche, but I was always reading. My mum, whenever she'd come to look for me, I would always be reading somewhere. It was something that was kind of cultivated. There were always books in the house, that we all had kind of library card members. So it was just very much a part of the fabric of my life to be reading. Yeah.
I like that you use the phrase, you could always find me, or I was always found reading. Because literally when we arrived today, for a start, I'm going to say this on the podcast, you were early. No one is ever early. So, I mean, incredible, an incredible start. But you were found reading.
Oh my God. Well, yeah, it was just, it is an addiction, a happy addiction, but I am never without a book. If I want to get a new bag or someone's giving me a present as a present, I always say just make sure it can carry a book. And often if I'm nearing the end of one, I will have another one ready to go. I'm never on a tube journey with nothing to read. I mean, I would find that unbearable.
And you brought your books today. I did. And I love that they are.
Oh God, you're going to embarrass me.
No, they're well thumbed.
They're well thumbed and they've got little like note points, and yeah, I'm very boffin-y about my books.
I'm exactly the same.
Good.
I feel like anyone who sort of criticises that treatment of a book is perhaps missing the fact that they're thumbed because they're loved.
Yeah.
I've written in the pages and I've folded down the pages because I loved it so much and it meant so much to me.
I don't think any author would mind that you love something so much you circle it with pen or you fold down the corner of a page. I just don't understand why they would love that. I mean, it also for me kind of crystallizes a certain thought or an idea in my mind if I circle it, because you spot it more immediately and you can sort of, you memorize it, or at least I do.
It's usually when I've seen the author articulate something that I felt or I've thought, but I've never been able to find the words for, because I don't have good enough words. And they do. And I want to then carry that around with me. I want to wear it around my neck like pearls. Yeah. a great feeling. What sort of books did you gravitate towards when you were a child?
I mean, anything that was put in front of me. I do remember my mum was brilliant at doing all the voices of, you know, Enid Blyton and A.A. Milne and that were the classic children's stories. But it was all fiction, obviously. But I mean, I did read everything, and I kind of didn't understand until I was a little bit older the things I was kind of gravitating more towards. So it would be less of, obviously, you read as you get older things like Goosebumps and stuff. But I found them fun, but I found them I didn't find them as interesting. So yeah. I thought, okay, I'm less interested in science fictiony things then. And then I read Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier when I was about, I must have been 11. A teacher called Mrs. Dandridge, in my first year of secondary school, just said to me, would you like to borrow my copy of Rebecca? I think you'd like it. And then I realised upon reading that, oh, I like fiction. I like these big, big novels that you can dive into.
It's quite a formative time, isn't it, working out what you like in all aspects of our lives. Mm-hmm. and literature is one of them. What do you now find yourself gravitating towards? Because it can really change depending on our needs as we get older.
It's still fiction, right. Definitely. I mean, I read a wide range of things, but I'm always don't feel fully kind of satiated unless it's a novel. I mean, and you go through patches where you read, you know, you just don't quite find the right fit for you for a book. And I find that inordinately difficult. Yeah. If you're kind of read a slew of maybe 4 or 5 books, and I've finished them unless I really, really don't respond to them. But I generally finish them so I can kind of have a comprehensive opinion of, mm-hmm. of why it is I don't like it. Because I do think that's as helpful as liking something. You know, when you land on a novel that fully engrosses you, I just find it the most enriching sensation. And I'll be talking to someone thinking, when will this conversation end so I can go and read my book? It's just quite...
I know the feeling. Sometimes a book can just not be giving at that time. There's been times when I've not felt it. I've not been feeling it. But then I've gone back, maybe even several years later, and I've been feeling it.
Yeah, definitely. I've definitely had that experience where I've just, something's been recommended or a friend has suggested something and I've not responded. And I thought, oh, I wonder why, you know, that we're so close and I'm surprised I don't like it if this close friend likes it. But then I've gone back to it and realised I just wasn't in the right frame of mind to read it. But it's definitely novels. I mean, I read short stories and nonfiction as well. I read essays, poetry, of course. But the kind of luxury of diving into an entire world is unmatched for me.
You've been in LA up until quite recently and filming. I know it's quite a rigorous schedule. Do you manage to find the time to dive into these worlds when you're already diving into several other worlds with your job?
I really do. Yeah. That one of the other actors on the show, Jessica Lowe, she would joke that in between takes, I would somewhere would have secreted a book about my person or on the set or in a drawer and would just immediately start reading. I mean, that sounds quite antisocial, but sometimes sets can be quite boring in between getting to do the acting. They can, there's a lot of time to kill. So, always reading. The job that I just did is set in the 1970s. I'm playing a feminist writer. So I was tending to read books that she would have been reading at that time because I enjoy them, and it was also sort of two birds one stone kind of thing. So I was reading, well, Joan Didion, Eve Babbitts, mm-hmm. Kate Millett, Betty Friedan, people like that.
On the subject of it feeling antisocial, I don't believe it is, because I once took a book on a date and I told my friends and they were like, you did not. But in my defense, if someone goes to the bar to buy a drink, you have a look at your phone for a bit, don't you? They go to the bar to buy a drink, I just open my book, just carry it on a little bit and then put it away. I don't think it's crazy. It's the same as like spending a little bit of time in between scenes on your phone.
Yes, and I actually find that much more distracting. I don't take my phone to set with me because it's just something about the screen, and I just find it ruptures my concentration so much more. Other people would say, well, surely diving into, you know, a novel set in the 16th century is going to be more distracting, but I because it's so distinct, I don't find it's quite clean for me. And I have always been able to dive in, come in and out of a book very easily. I don't kind of need silence. I don't need to, I, you know, grew up in quite a rowdy household, and I can read anywhere. So a set for me that kind of, the kind of comfort of the hubbub around me is actually quite soothing. So it's like white noise.
Well, we're going to be diving in and out of five of your favourite books, starting with Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. When 16-year-old Janie is caught kissing local do-nothing Johnny Taylor, her grandmother swiftly marries her off to an old man with 60 acres. Janie survives two stifling marriages before she finally meets the man of her dreams, who offers not diamonds, but a packet of flowering seeds. How much do you love this book?
I mean, that's a lot of hyperbole is going to be involved now, but it's all accurate. It's, I had never read anything like it. I discovered it because I had read Zadie Smith's White Teeth, devoured that, and then read that it was, she wrote that it was one of her favourite novels. So I immediately bought it. And I had just read nothing like it. I just was so impressed by Janie and her kind of her fortitude and her tenacity to believe, like, the kind of had that, she had this ardent desire in the power of love and the kind of healing power of love. And there's she says in it somewhere, there's the dream is the truth, and she kind of sticks by this adage, and I just found that it was just incredibly inspiring. Just thought she was such an impressive person to become friends with. You felt like you're becoming friends with her.
When did you read it?
I was probably, it was right after I read White Teeth, and that came out when I was maybe 14. So I must have been 14, right. 15.
So as a coming of age tale, as it were, as a protagonist who you could probably relate to, did it resonate? Did she resonate?
I tell you what resonated was she discovers who she is by hurling herself into life. She doesn't sit back and allow life to happen. She fearlessly allows these experiences. And I had started acting when I was 10, and I knew immediately upon my first encounter with acting, this is what I'm going to do. And obviously that sounds incredibly precocious, and you know, people might humour you, but I knew. And I remember, and when I read that and saw that she was just, there's this wonderful passage where she's sitting beneath a tree, and she sees a bumblebee, and its kind of wings are loaded down with pollen, and she just finds the kind of the beauty and the strength and the kind of tenacity of this tiny creature, and she finds, and she kind of locks her sort of hopes onto it felt to me like she was inspired by something that was so small that it kind of made her feel powerful. And it was just, yeah, that was what I responded to, the idea that if you believe in something, that is enough. Like, the dream is the truth. And I remember thinking, like, this is, you know, people might be kind of belittling this idea that I want to be an actor, you know, girl off a housing estate. What do I know? But it was, no, I dream it, so I'm going to do it.
And you did. Well, Janie evolves from a voiceless teen to a woman in control of her own destiny, as you just said. So do you feel like you've reached a point where you're in control of your destiny, in control of the things that happen in your life?
I don't know that I would say I'm in control of it. I think freedom comes from not trying to be in control. I think I've felt more stressed when I've tried to control things. You know, that phrase, control the controllables. I used to get so, not anxious, but nervous when auditioning, for example. And then as soon as I just thought, this serves no purpose, just enjoy it. Just if not trying to control it, I discovered there was much more freedom, and I was a more accurate version of myself, because I wasn't kind of aping what I thought people would want. So I know I wouldn't say that I am in control of it. And I mean, especially with what I do, I could be on a plane to South Africa tomorrow and filming there for 7 months, and you just don't know. But that's, I find that exhilarating. If you lean into not knowing, I think there's more joy and more peace in that.
You were saying just before we started recording that the shooting schedule most recently has been so intense, but you love it.
I really do. I'm really annoying in the mornings, because I'm genuinely eager to get to set. I mean, I sending, there's an 8-hour time difference between LA and London. I was sending, responding to messages to my sister, and it was about 4 a.m. with me, and I was like, look at the palm trees, aren't they lovely? and dancing in the van with my driver, and just, we came into one of the trailers, and Jake Johnson, who's another actor on the show, he was still in the hair chair, which is a chair you get your hair done, not a chair made of hair, to clarify.
So I think I've seen a horror movie about one of them.
yeah, and any day now. And I was kind of dancing around him to Fleetwood Mac or something. We always have music going. And he was like, are you always this lively, this early? I was like, you betcha. It's just, I do. I find you get very, you build a kind of momentum. You get real stamina. So it's almost like flexing a muscle. It just gets stronger. So and because filming Minx was particularly fun, why would you find it anything but exhilarated? So yeah, the schedule was full on, but you know, it's when you're doing what you love, it's like a day at the spa.
Well, Minx, it tackles complex issues like female pleasure and race and power. When you were, I guess, at the time that you would have been reading this book, when you were a teen and you were starting to form your opinions, your thoughts, your feelings about those topics, do you feel that that's something that's evolved since doing this show?
Yes, I do, actually. I was struck when reading that, I was watching God, that she explores kind of gender roles and in kind of emancipation and female empowerment, and they were, and those were explored. There's lots of kind of imagery around her hair and around the tree and a mule, and there's, and I remember it was articulating ideas that I was becoming familiar with by that age, 14, 15, or becoming engaged with. But it is interesting all of these years later to be shooting a show like Minx, and there, you know, it's set in the 70s, it's set 50 years ago, but we're still now having the same conversations, and there's a kind of contemporaneous aspect to the show which is depressing. And we shouldn't still be having these conversations, but there are certainly things about, yeah, female pleasure and women being active in their desire, for example, and even the way it's spoken about still today in quite a kind of ambiguous way, that has made me engage with those issues kind of all over again. And you kind of you realize that they're not resolved, they're not going to become resolved, but the show has made me re-examine them and have different conversations with my friends that I'm very close with. We're all kind of liberal, outspoken, and widely read, so you challenge it. We don't always agree on everything, of course, but this Minx brought up topics that I realized I haven't spoken a great deal to my friends about, like their pleasure and desire and the complexity of consent and things like that. It's not actually something we've spoken about at great length explicitly.
Well, long may we speak about these subjects, and I hope that conversation evolves as it will have done from when you read this book to when you're filming this show and into the future. We move on now to your second book, Shelfie Book, which is Play It As It Lays by Joan Didion. By turns heartbreaking and disturbing, this novel follows hollowed-out actress Maria Wyeth as her life plays out in a numbing routine of perpetual freeway driving. In her early 30s, divorced from her husband, dislocated from her friends, Maria is a woman who has run out of both desires and purpose. Did this resonate? I really get the impression it didn't, but we've been talking about it.
Maria, they didn't resonate in that way, but I was totally knocked sideways by this book. I'd read The Year of Magical Thinking and I had read Slouching Towards Bethlehem, the first of which is about the dealing with her grief after the loss of her husband, the second a collection of essays that she wrote in the 60s. This was the first novel of hers that I'd read, and what I found so arresting about it was the kind of deceptive simplicity of it. I mean, for example, some of the chapters are a few sentences and that's it, and I would find that the thoughts between the words would sort of linger in my mind weeks of hang like vivid paintings that I would need to kind of close the book and allow those to sort of ruminate for a while before I moved on to the next chapter. And I hadn't really done that. These chapters would be tight, just a few sentences, and they were so powerful. I think, what has she said? Because often I find reading Didion, at least, you feel something before being able to identify what it is you feel. But like when you might walk into a room and there's a smell you recognise, but you can't pinpoint it, but you know you mm-hmm. smell something. What is it? Ah, it's my mother's perfume. That's what it is. But it's, her words are like that. There's such a kind of evocative power in them that's what resonated.
Right.
And I just thought, I have never read anyone like this. I've never encountered a writer so searing, the way she can capture a personality with kind of skewers an identity to the page with just a single sentence. I mean, this is in another book, I think it's in Democracy, where she talks about a woman who lights a cigarette with a match against her shoe, the sole of her shoe, and you just immediately understand, well, where's she been? How has she learned to do that? Who showed her that? Why is she doing that? Why doesn't she use the matchbox? You just have so many questions and answers about this woman immediately. And Joan Didion has this unique aptitude to do that.
I guess there's a familiarity as well when her images are so searing, as you put it, so evocative. The book's set just outside of Hollywood. It's full of existential angst and alienation.
Yeah, it's a laugh a minute.
Is it a side to Hollywood that you recognise, that you've seen or you've heard about from your friends or colleagues?
Yes, I have. You know, I started going to LA when I was about 21 or 22. And I mean, it was a baptism of fire. Mm. I was in all sorts of things happen. They just thought, wow, it really is the beauty and the beast, this place, because it was so full of hope and the dreams, and people kind of come from all over the place. But for that reason, there can be a sort of creeping dread to it. There can be the kind of unrelenting blaze of the sun, and everyone is in the industry. There's this sort of a relentless energy to it that if you're not part of that current, it can pull you under. People go there to kind of live out their dreams, but quite often die without achieving them, and there can be a sense of that there. So you need to sort of find your own people, you need to find your own purpose, you need to, I found when I was going there initially, just it was just so soul crushing, and you'd go to pilot season, it was just, you're just 10 a penny. It really, your sense of self-esteem and self-worth is, your sense of value is so married to the idea of success that it taught me very quickly, you need to have another way of placing value on yourself. It cannot be tied up with this, because if you don't work for 2, 3, 4 years, then what are you worth? And reading this book, you see how dangerous it is it feels like her self-worth is really dangerously entangled with her success as an actress.
What's been your process of finding that sense of self-worth, recognizing it, and then working out how to achieve it without the external?
I mean, it's not like I've arrived. I'm much better at it than I was. But honestly, reading, remembering that it's always been a source of comfort and
always
joy for me. You're never alone with a book. And knowing that as much as I love what I do, it is what I do. It is not who I am. And there are so many other things that I am, you know. And my friends, obviously, everyone values that they're friends, but they're such kind of... Seeing your friends, it's that they're such a shot in the arm, just remembering that there's so much more value to be had from being a good friend than that. I mean, it sounds so... I sound like I'm kind of in a Lady Bird book, but it's true. Just try not to think, right, well, I'm only worth something if I get this big part in this show with this person. That's just so temporary and fleeting and subjective. That so I do find that furnishing myself with things that make me feel happy, really simple things like swimming in the sea and reading a good book and seeing my friends and being there for them, makes me feel valued and valuable.
Yeah, and grounded, I guess, yes, as well. And what is it like moving? Because I know your home is here in London, but you're spending a lot of time in LA. What's it like going between continents? How do you find it?
I love it. Yeah. I love it so much. I've got, my mum was a real travel bug, so she kind of instilled that in us. We, you know, you'd mention that you were doing reading a play set in Afghanistan. She's like, oh yeah, I really liked Afghanistan for the month that I was there. When were you in Afghanistan?
Doing what, mum?
She was like, well, you know, this and that. And or then you'd mention Germany. She's like, oh yeah, I remember throwing things over the wall for people. Like what? Plastic bags? They didn't have any plastic bags or jeans. So like, when did you do that? Oh, you know, just, you know. And then she kind of would be quite ambiguous about it. And you'd think, okay, I won't ask any more questions. But she instilled the idea of the hunger for travel and the curiosity. And, you know, we didn't go to your typical places. We'd kind of go to Thailand and explore those kinds of things or go camping. But so the idea of getting to travel with my job is a massive appeal to me. It's, I mean, I really am aware of how lucky I am that, I mean, I did one job where we got to go to Russia, Cambodia, Italy and South Africa.
What job was this?
It was called Hooten and the Lady. It was an action adventure show. I just, because I, you know, I read the episodes and I saw where they were set and I thought, oh, right, okay, great. There's going to be some brilliant aircraft hangar and, you know, tripping soddery that will do the job. And then you go, oh no, here's my visa to go to Cambodia. This is incredible. So I love getting to travel. And the fact that Minx was shot in LA, God, this is so, I'm such a cornball sometimes. I just never got tired of seeing the Hollywood sign. I was staying in an apartment that looked directly on its Hollywood sign. Just kind of think, this is ridiculous. This is so much fun. And it just never grew up. I mean, as I said, I grew up on a housing estate in White City. So, and it was, I still at 36 am, it's not wasted on me that I do feel so grateful I actually get to do it. And then seeing the Hollywood sign outside your window as you're kind of getting up to go to work and be paid to try and make people laugh is just a bit, they're real pinch me moments.
But I think practicing that gratitude every single moment of every single day, even if it's for the rest of your life and you never get tired of seeing that, I think that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I can, but it does lead people to think, oh my God, you're so annoying when I'm dancing around at 4 a.m. I need to temper my excitement sometimes.
Well, it comes from your mum, who sounds like an absolute legend. Baileys is proudly supporting the Women's Prize for Fiction by helping showcase incredible writing by remarkable women, celebrating their accomplishments and getting more of their books into the hands of more people. Looking for a treat to pair with your favourite book? Baileys is the perfect accompaniment to enjoy either over ice or over coffee.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Your third bookshelfy book is To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf. Arguably one of Woolf's greatest works, this short novella opens with Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey and their 8 children holidaying at their summer house in Skye, surrounded by family friends. But time passes, bringing with it war and death, and the summer home stands empty until one day, many years later, the family return to make their long-postponed visit. Can you tell us why you picked this book?
Well, Virginia Woolf has been a big part of my life in many different ways. I first read this book when I was about 13 or 14, which was far too young. But again, it was actually at the suggestion of the same teacher, Mrs. Dandridge. And I didn't quite respond to it. And then I read it again at the suggestion of another teacher named Mr. Chivers when I was about 16. And it was a completely different experience, like we were saying before. I was just too young to appreciate it before. And it was a revelation to me. I mean, that sounds, you know, quite rapturous, but it really was. Wolf has a way of articulating that she has such perspicacity in the way that she kind of skew, again, captures an identity. And she was able to articulate ideas that I knew I had, but they were too murky to identify. And it was, and then upon reading Wolf, it was like a light was shone on those ideas and I could see them clearly, and the kind of the satisfaction, the kind of the swell that you experience when you see your thoughts articulated on a page, and like the recognition, you feel like that you're having a real communion with this person, and it's quite magical, really. And she, and To the Lighthouse was that experience for me, and it awoke in me an awareness of ideas, like I said, that I knew that I'd had, but just wasn't quite able to articulate. You know, the idea of gender roles, female emancipation, female empowerment, that it was, I knew, obviously by that age, the ideas of feminism and everything, but I wasn't, it really awoke in me a kind of fearsome alignment with feminism. And I went on to read everything she wrote. And I mean, it's so much so that I was 16 when I read that book, and I was at sixth form college, and I thought that I was going to just after college go straight into working as an actor, but big thanks to Mr. Chivers and that, and him suggesting that I read that book, and in fact he made me realize that I clearly loved modernist fiction, so I went on to read so many modernist authors. I decided, actually no, I want to go to university and study English. It completely changed the course of my life. And I knew I wanted to be an actor. I was already acting. I was already working, making money as an actor while continuing with my schooling. But because of To the Lighthouse, I decided I want to go to university and luxuriate in studying books for 3 years. And I want to write my dissertation on Virginia Woolf. And that's what I did.
Oh, did you?
And it's, I mean, I won on Virginia Woolf. The other one I wrote on James Joyce. So, you know, both quite lighthearted.
What was your dissertation on Virginia Woolf? What were you
I exploring? Wrote about her use of moon imagery across several of her books, and how she would use that to explore madness and badness and sadness in women.
Wonderful. I feel like it's been a long time since doing a dissertation, but if anyone ever asked me, I'm like, oh yeah, I've not talked about that for a while, but there was a time when it was my entire life.
Yeah. Whole life. I mean, but just in a brilliant way. I mean, it's funny, you just think when you encounter an author at the right time, and that's truly what she was. And I'm so glad that I did have her around in the university days. And then going on to read A Room of One's Own and just feeling so fired up by that, and to think when that was written, I mean, I think To the Lighthouse was written in 1927, and to think I was reading it all of these years later, and the kind of the passion that it evoked in me was, I mean, you can hear how passionate I've become about them, but she really did awaken in me a realization that I was a feminist, and I would fight for those ideals, and that I was, if I was, could do anything to continue these ideas and talking about these things, and I would. So she really does loom large in my life still.
I'm getting this image of you as a child, as a teenager, as a student, sort of growing up. I know this book, it opens in a busy family household. You said yourself you were used to your household being a loud one, and mm-hmm. We've got a little glimpse of your mum as well. I know it was a single parent family. Tell us a little bit more about your mother, your family, your household that you grew up in, and how it shaped the person that you are.
Well, yeah, my parents divorced when I was six. My dad was still in the picture, we lived with my mum. I've got older brother, younger sister, and we were a foster family. We fostered children for 17 years. So that was you know, a rowdy house.
Wow.
And it was a small house. So we were all on top of each other, kind of cheek by jowl. But my mum is just an absolute force of nature. She's funny, she's intelligent, she's naughty, she's witty, she's beautiful, she's the best possible role model you could ask for. and incredibly supportive without being, you know, meddling. She, I mean, when I, a 10-year-old tells you you want to be an actor, she didn't dismiss it, but she didn't kind of force me into it. She just let me do it. And I remember when I got my first paycheck at 12, I said, what do I do with it? She said, it's not my money, it's your money, you do with it what you want. So, classic 12-year-old, I put it into a bond that I couldn't trust until I was 18.
Ah.
Don't know where I got that idea from, but that's what I did.
12-year-olds and their bonds. What are we like?
Really, really weird. it was full of activity, and you'd argue and you'd fight and you'd make up. It was lots of books everywhere, and my sister was studying dance at that point. My brother was kind of into the drama, but didn't like it in the way that I liked it. It was a really fun household. I mean, I was very independent. I suppose I was quite, from a really young age, like precociously independent, wanted to kind of go off and do my own thing. So I remember when I'd be working on the set and my mum would have to be there because I needed a chaperone. I hated it. Not because I'd hate my mum, I adored my mum, but I just thought, I'm fine, I'm doing it, I don't need you here. Mm. Obviously you think you're such a grown up at that age, but it was a really fun household.
And it shapes the person that you become. How much of yourself do you now put into your roles? I mean, obviously with someone like, say, Carrie Johnson, there's a lot of research that would need doing, and it's someone who has been portrayed by the media a lot as well. But can you bring yourself to these roles?
I mean, I think that varies, of course, with who you play. I mean, with Joyce Prigger in Minx, there's a lot of... I mean, all of my friends, when I told them I was playing that role, they just said, this feels like it has literally been written for you. I mean, I make myself sound so uncool. A lot of the books that she would be talking about and kind of, you should read this. And I had read all of them. And the creator of the show, Ellen Raffel, she was like, of course you have. And I had copies of them and they were thumbed and they were underlined. And I kind of brought my copies of the books that the character talks about with me. Such a loser. But with Carrie Johnson, you know, we grew up in similar areas-ish, both kind of West London. She's only a couple of years younger than I am. I realised that I knew some people she'd gone to school with, so I was able to speak to them. I mean, there was that kind of proximity. But we grew up worlds apart in terms of our socioeconomic. She was much wealthier than I was. But you still bring yourself to it in terms of you can't play what you've read about. I find that really irresponsible. There was the director, Michael Winterbottom, sort of said, you are playing a woman who is pregnant and whose husband is in the public eye. That's who you're playing. So you weren't playing Carrie Antoinette or all of these kind of other... Mm.
The headlines,
kind of unkind nicknames, whether they were fair or not is irrelevant. The point is you can't use a newspaper article to kind of build your characterization. You go off primarily the script that's in front of you, and it's, you know, you, I realized that lots of people had very kind of entrenched opinions about her, and I would ask her, but what's that based on? What, oh well, we've heard this and the other, thought, but you've not met her, you don't know. I mean, and I didn't speak to her either, but because again, I thought that would, not that I doubt she would have agreed, but not like I've got context her and ask her. I just thought that would colour my impression of her. So you do, I brought myself to it in terms of thinking, well, how would I feel if my husband was in a great position of power and I felt like he was making mistakes, and I, you know, Carrie's, by all accounts, is very intelligent, she's well educated, we know that, she knows what she's talking about in this instance, so it of course he must have asked her opinion on things. What partner doesn't ask their partner for an opinion? She happened to know what she was talking about. The problem lies in the fact that she's not, you know, she was not an elected official, and she may have been giving him details she shouldn't have been. But in terms of bringing myself to that, I thought, well, I've certainly done that. I've given my opinion on things, often unsolicited. I think you can't help but do that. But the fun part in what I do, though, is that often you don't understand the motivations of someone immediately. You do kind of think, oh, I wouldn't do that. So then you can start exploring, well, I wonder why they did. Let's think of some backstory. Let's furnish this with a kind of emotional world that you can then understand why they would behave that way. That often it's fun to play someone who's unlike yourself.
Well, on the subject of furnishing a story with the parts that we don't always get to hear, we move on to your fourth book, which is Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell.
Oh, gosh.
Yes. Take a big, deep breath.
Yeah.
This Women's Prize winning novel explores the short life of Hamnet Shakespeare. This is a tenderly written and emotionally devastating account of the bard's only son, whose name was given to one of the most celebrated plays ever written. Tell me why it solicited such a deep breath, such a sigh.
I was completely spellbound by this book. It's devastating. It's almost unbearable, kind of the aching beauty in its pages. I'd read it fortuitously by the sea in Cornwall, which, you know, was the ideal setting because it felt so elemental. The way Farrell builds a kind of sense of place. I still think about the characters in that book. They still occupy space in my mind. And I know that sounds absurd, but they really do. And I think that is magical to kind of... I think it's so exciting. I discovered Maggie O'Farrell with Hamnet, so quite late in the day. But it was just thrilling to fall so hopelessly in love with a writer and then realise there's so much other things that I can now devour. Like it was just so exciting. And to realise it's kind of emphasised that there are so many authors out there yet to discover. I mean, there's no excuse to be bored because there's so much to be read. And I'm almost at a loss for words to describe. There aren't enough superlatives to describe how breathtaking her writing is, especially in this book. The sheer creativity of how she articulates the world. It's the fact that she gives you such a sensory experience before you've even met the characters. You can kind of smell the sawdust and feel its crunch beneath your feet against the flagstones that have been, you know, become shiny from centuries of footfall. You can see the kind of pleasing blaze of the fire in the hearth. You can hear its crackling in your ears, and all of that to build the room in which you're soon to hear these voices. It kind of, you have such a sense of place before you've even met someone. It's truly remarkable. I mean, I get so fired up when I think about that, and just think, These are black marks on a page. These are just words on a page, and I feel like I lose all sense of where and when I am when I'm reading her. And as I say, I was reading this in Cornwall by the Sea, and this actually was the one book that I have not been able to just dip in and dip out of, the way I was saying before. I'm good at doing that. Once I was in this world, I was in it, and I couldn't be taken away from it. And it really did feel like sticking my head underwater. It was just a completely different world. And the power of a writer to be able to wholly absorb you and you're kind of within its clutches is just kind of bliss.
I feel like if any of our listeners haven't read it yet, then that will ensure that they do. They will be going straight out and getting a copy.
I hope it truly is. Oh my God. I mean, I haven't reread it yet because I just can't.
Well, it sounds like that experience was so visceral.
Yes.
Of reading it, you almost don't want to ruin your memory of it and the impact of it.
Mm.
Then it was not just in space but also in time. That,
yes,
that was your experience of this book.
Definitely. And it still moves around. So, I mean, I know it sounds like I'm exaggerating, but I think about those people and their lives. They're still in my head.
They continue to live
on inside you.
Yeah.
She made it all up. I mean, yes, of course, these people did exist in reality, but we don't. One of the reasons why I love this book as well is that O'Farrell gave Shakespeare's wife in actual life. She watched, you know, there was so much erroneous things written about her. We didn't know anything about her. So she's created this narrative that's so much more satisfying. But I don't feel like I want to read it again yet, because they're all still in there. They're all still there so vividly that I'm kind of still thinking about things. Will remind me of stuff that I've read in the book. It's remarkable. I read that in 2020s, and it's still doing that.
Did reading Hamlet affect how you read or view or think about Shakespeare's work now? Because presumably, you know, you must have read a lot of Shakespeare studying English at uni.
Yes, actually, which is curious, because of course Ophara's made it all up. So, I mean, of course she researched it heavily, and she, of course, all of those sorts of things, but the specificities of what Agnes goes through is from Ophara's imagination. But yes, it did. You know, the fact that he sent all of his money back to Stratford-upon-Avon to support his wife and his children, the fact that reading my namesake, my name is from Hamlet. Like, I kind of thought about that play in a very different way after reading this book. I mean, to think that it's a writer, you know, a contemporary writer would affect how I think about someone from centuries ago is that as well exposes how magical writing can be, that it can reframe something with which you feel so familiar, and opens up whole other sort of antechambers of thought that you simply not engage with, but you realise were there dormant all along in your mind, and you think, well, how much more is there to be discovered? What other dust sheets will be whipped off from covered up rooms that, thanks to a writer's imagination? I find that endlessly exciting.
Well, as you just said as well, the book is largely told from the perspective of Agnes, Shakespeare's wife, a figure largely lost from history. Mm. When you pick your roles and all these wonderful roles that you have taken on, are you drawn to fleshing out women's stories, particularly untold women's stories in your work?
I mean, yes, definitely. That was one of the appeals actually of playing Carrie Johnson, because I did think we don't know much about her. Actually, she's, despite being a public figure, she's very carefully curated her public image, and you can see why. You can see how she's been, regardless of how you vote, regardless of how you feel. I do think we can agree that the way she was kind of portrayed in the press is really dangerous, and to me it does smack of misogyny, and I find that obviously problematic. So the opportunity to play her and kind of just play her as a person without applying my politics to it, I felt was needed. I mean, there are lots of characters that, you know, you read about in that I'd love to have the opportunity to play. Obviously it's a fictional character, but Joyce Prigger in Minx, that it's by playing her we're able to kind of flesh out the idea of an imperfect feminist. You know, the fact that she's got all of these ideals and thinks that she knows what she's doing, and then she encounters people that are different from her and she realizes, oh, actually there's so much I've not understood. I mean, she's not an intersectional feminist, right, at that point. She's completely lived in her little kind of white middle class bubble. She hasn't encountered people who've lived a different life to her. So through the show, I mean, yes, it's essentially a workplace comedy, but we are able to flesh out people that aren't often represented. And because we're shooting it in, you know, 2023, we were able to apply a greater understanding of those oversights, which wouldn't have occurred in the 70s, but, you know, that's the benefit of hindsight.
Well, in Minx, there is this increased focus on female agency and honouring the female rather than the male gaze. In what ways do you create that feminist lens on set?
Well, there are lots of willies, which is wonderful. Love my job.
This is why I was up
jolly at 5 a.m. because it's the female gaze. You don't get to see women's pleasure depicted on screen often. It's kind of or spoken about in a way that's I mean, it sounds absurd, but not hyper-sexualized. Just speak, you know, acknowledging that it exists, even. We're able to, it's all very much, I mean, yes, it's heteronormative, but the female gaze, there, what do, the fact that women are active in their desire, this kind of fallacy that it's kind of, you know, something passive that happens to you is just not mine and my female friends' experience at all. And it, what's so satisfying about the show is that it explores that and kind of debunks just myths that seem to kind of still have a lot of traction. And of course, you know, the lovely, I mean, I don't know what my you know, friends will say about this, but it's just a different show. The set feels very different. I mean, there's a lot of female energy. There's the storylines focus on female agency and kind of, and but also acknowledging when you make mistakes in that way and it not being the end of the world, and you can make a mistake and learn. What I often feel like men are afforded the space to make mistakes and not have to be kind of totally vilified for it. I feel like there's a lot less margin for error for women. And I like that Joyce, she's a flawed person, and you see the people around her telling her as such, but still embracing her into the fold. So I think that's an important message as well, that, you know, allow women to have opinions without calling them opinionated.
We move on to your fifth and final book this week, which is in fact a poem. It is Song by Christina Rossetti. Christina Rossetti was one of the leading female poets of the Victorian era. Song, famously beginning, "When I am dead, my dearest," remains one of her best loved poems. Why did you pick it?
Well, I chose this because I've long enjoyed Rossetti's poetry, as many people have. This poem in particular was a lifeline of sorts for me. My friend Caroline took her own life a few years ago, and it happened right as we went into lockdown. And it was the most painful experience I have had the misfortune of experiencing. And we were completely alone, and it was so difficult to kind of understand what had happened and accept what had happened. And I just was reading, trying to kind of keep myself afloat. And I read this poem, and it was like someone had just reached in and just pulled me out of something dangerous. It was, the power of that poem to keep me afloat is extraordinary, really, because obviously you're speaking to your friends and everything, but this poem in particular felt like it was almost Carrie herself saying it. There's a particular line when I feel myself getting drawn into the kind of the agony of the grief, like it feels so physical, that it just, as soon as it comes to my mind, I feel pulled back from the brink, and it's, "Be the green grass above me." It's the most beautiful notion, that it feels like Carrie saying, don't be silly, don't sit there, what's the point of sitting there moping? Live life and live it well. Live it because I no longer am. Live it for me. Don't sit there and mope. Be the green grass above me. This serves no purpose to sit and mope. Obviously, grieve for her, but don't allow that to overwhelm all of the other feelings about her. And I'm telling you, that poem is the power of that, to just kind of go, right, come on, up you get. I cannot put a value on that. It is invaluable. And I think some people can often find that poetry is inaccessible, or it's, oh, you know, you need a degree to be able to understand it. It's just simply not the case. And I it's like people saying that about Joyce. I wish Joyce would hate that. But it's like a short, sharp shock, a shot in the arm poetry, when you read at just the right moment. Mm-hmm. And it can truly lift you from yourself, and it can articulate something that you're feeling, and it almost gives you a guiding light for that moment, and then lifts you out of it. And that poem never fails to lift me up and make me feel like I'm going to do her proud.
What does living life well mean to you? What does doing Caroline proud in the way that you live your life mean to you?
It means to not let the fuckers get you down. You know, gosh, I mean, that's a hard question to answer, but it means to just go to, I mean, going back to Janie, to kind of discover who you are by hurling yourself into life and not hiding away from it. And Carrie was such a dynamo. She was such a force for joy that I'm going to continue in that vein for her, but and for myself, to not just surrender your power to someone because of fear, but to just to kind of step into it and do things that are unfamiliar and challenge yourself and all of those kind of cliches. But you just think, we're so often kind of wings clipped, curtailed and told to be one thing. There's no reason you can... I'm learning to get my pilot's license at the moment.
You're doing what?
Because I was like, I want to be a pilot.
I want to fly.
I want to be a pilot. So I was like, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm gonna get my pilot's license. So that's what
wow.
I'm doing.
Wow.
Just why not? I might, you know, then I can be the new Tom Cruise. It just means to just go out and do all of the things. Yeah. You don't have to be one thing. It can be many things. And I'm just so grateful to poetry like that, to a piece of poetry that you kind of remind, you know it, you can know something intellectually, but to feel it emotionally. Actually, Joan Didion in The Year of Magical Thinking, she writes about knowing that her husband is dead, but not being able to throw away his shoes in case he needs them. And those two thoughts coexisting, they sound so contradictory, and yet they are just, they're both perfectly valid, because you can understand something intellectually but not quite yet have grasped it emotionally. And oftentimes that happens with Carrie. Like, I'll still think to text her, and or I'll see a meme and want to send it to her and realize, oh God, I can't. But then I remember, be the green grass above me, and I can still enjoy knowing that she would have found it funny. It doesn't need to kind of, my conversation with her continues, but just in a different way now. So I think that's living life well.
Poetry is so powerful.
Mm.
It is that short, sharp shot that you just described. Do you find time to read poetry in your day-to-day, or is it something that you maybe reach for when you need it, or something that just takes you by surprise, like this one did, when it turns out you needed it, but you don't necessarily know you need it?
I tend to have poetry books dotted around the house. Right. I don't have them kind of all on the shelf like the novels are, for that purpose. Ali Asiri has done beautiful collections of poetry, you know, Poem for Every Day of the Year or Poem for Every Spring Day and things like that. So it's quite nice to have them just around, so that you, while you're waiting for the kettle to boil, you just flick open a page and read it. I think it's quite nice to have poetry around, so you can dip into it as easily as that. And then there are some poets that I reach for specifically when, I don't know, you're walking along and there's a full moon and I think, oh, I should read some Basho. It's
And we know how you love the moon. From your dissertation.
I love the bloody moon, me. Can't get enough of the moon. I really do talk about the moon a lot. I kind of such a woman.
Oh no, join the club. I do too. Between the pieces of poetry dotted around for when you need them, the books that are sitting here in front of me, Hamnet that you devoured by the sea, all the books on your shelves, it's been amazing to get to talk to you about the words that have shaped you, that have impacted you. If you had to choose just one book,
oh God, I knew you were going to ask that,
from your list that you brought today as a favourite, which one would it be and why? Have a little, yeah, a little shuffle through.
I think it would be Hamnet.
Yeah.
I think it would be Hamnet. Yeah, because it's just... well, look, for someone so loquacious, I'm rendered speechless. So I think that kind of says it all.
Says a lot, yeah. I
just think it's a truly extraordinary, transportive piece of writing. And I'll never tire of diving into it.
And once again, to anyone who hasn't read it, who's listening, I think you should be sold by now.
Yeah, I want a commission on that piece, O'Farrell.
Ophelia, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
We said we were going to dive into these bits. We well and truly dove into them. honestly, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat to you.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
I'm Vic Hope, and you've been listening to the Women's Prize for Fiction podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Baileys and produced by Birdline Media. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.